I personally have given up in Northeast. Like a lot of black people, a lot of black people said, I'm getting the heck out of here. And they either abandoned their properties or they sold them if they could find somebody to take it, and they got the heck out. And that's what I wanted to do.
And welcome into Priced Out, the podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Morgan, alongside Cornelius Swart. How you doing today, man?
Good, sir. How are you?
Pretty good. I'm excited about today's show. We got an in-studio guest.
Yeah, today, in-studio, so to speak, is Fred Stewart, who's perhaps the most controversial Portlander I know. He was one of the voices in Priced Out. Fred was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but he was raised in the black neighborhoods of Northeast Portland starting in the 70s. And he's a realtor. He's a political activist. He's run twice for city council here in Portland. And he's a social media firebrand. And he's constantly challenging the assumptions of the political allegiances that are shown to liberals by both black and white folks. And he's always sort of blasting. You say that Barack Obama is your favorite president, but you're always blasting far right wing videos onto social media. And you're always ripping white liberals, new a-holes, for everything from gun control to rent control. And so you're a fascinating guy. So much of what you said is important, but got left out of the movie. So you are part of the cutout series, stuff that we wanted to have a conversation about, but we just didn't have the time. So thanks for coming.
No, anything I can do, I share as much as I can, because I there's a lot of things that are wrong about what's happened and are happening right now. I want people to think about it, because I don't want this to happen again. And with black people, it's very easy to not think about the unintended consequences.
When you say you don't want this to happen again, what do you mean?
I don't want people being left out. You know, black people got lucky this time that left out meant that the ones that stayed behind, you know, were able to enjoy a lot of equity, you know, a lot of growth. We've got black people literally right now who 30 years ago, they weren't doing well financially, and now they're buying BMWs every year, some because they didn't sell what they had, you know. But most black people, because 30 years ago, right now, about 30-40% of the real estate that we call inner north and northeast Portland was actually owned by black people. But 30 years ago, we still had redlining, and black people could not manipulate that land, really. I mean, if you were going to put a store or a restaurant, you went down to Home Depot. You did it, you know, you and your cousin.
Couldn't get a construction loan, couldn't get a zoning variance, couldn't get like any of the things that you'd normally think like a white homeowner or white business person would be able to get, right?
They didn't exist back then, but RH Construction, you didn't call RH Construction up and say, hey, I want to put a restaurant in this building. Can you come down and put the kitchen in? Back then, a restaurant cost like 50 grand. Well, to give you an idea, if the restaurant costs 50 grand, I can name several buildings on MLK that are worth millions today that weren't worth 20.
Right.
So, you know what I mean? And that's what's talking about. The inner Northeast Portland, the critical problem inner Northeast Portland had back then was because of redlining, it had no equity.
Right.
We literally tore down some houses in inner Northeast Portland because they needed a new roof.
Right. And it would cost more.
It would cost more to do the roof than what the appraised value of the house was.
Right. So nobody would loan you money to do it.
Yeah, nobody would loan you money. And why would they? If it's going to cost you $5,000 to put a roof on a house and the house is only worth about $3,500. I mean, one of my favorite stories about inner Northeast Portland was in June of 1985. There was a guy named Bill Reed. He developed the Standard Dairy building.
Yeah.
He went down to Benjamin Franklin. Bill comes from a very wealthy family. You know, I don't talk about it publicly, but you know his family. He comes from a very wealthy East Coast family, and a nice guy. And he's your typical white liberal, cool dude. He came out here, loves Portland for all the other things, and he specifically went into inner Northeast Portland because that was what he thought was a culture war. So this guy goes down to Benjamin Franklin. He saw an ad. They were selling houses. So went down there to look.
So this is a bank, so people don't know. Franklin.
It was a savings and loan. During the savings and loan crisis.
Right.
And then in 91, B of A took them over. They were seized by the government, and B of A took them over. He took down $150,000 thinking he would buy 3 or 4 homes. You know, that was about right. He walked out of the building with over 200. 200 deeds. By the time Bill Reed stopped visiting Benjamin Franklin, he had almost 700 homes. And he spent about $300,000.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. They were just giving them away. This is what I was telling everybody. When I got into real estate in September of 1988, right, Inner Northeast Portland was up for grabs. Mm-hmm. People were just giving the real, I mean, I literally in my career have given some incredible homes away. You know what I mean? And this is what, you know, I like to talk about this because people look at today and, they, you know, like you did your video and this woman's talking about how she was, you know, priced out and stuff. And I'm thinking, gee whiz, she lived up the street from the, you know, the Manyweathers. Manyweathers must have sold at least 10 properties. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm talking about just said, hey, I don't want them. What if the Manyweathers had kept them? You know what I mean? Just kept them. But I can understand why Mr. Manyweather didn't want to keep it, you know, keep the property. Mm-hmm. Guys, properties were a burden. Mm-hmm. Vacant lots were going for $500 because usually the you have to cut the grass mm-hmm. or you get fined. Plus, yeah. I don't know if you know this. If you have a vacant lot, you still have to pay a minimum of $450 a year in water fees because of the water meter.
Huh, interesting. So well, but let's get back to this. So we jumped in yeah. with that you don't want to see this happen again. And you, what you meant by that was that the Black community could have made more money with the gentrification cycle. But there are a lot of people who did make money
correct.
In the gentrification cycle that happened here in the last 20 years. And that is something that you've always said and that didn't make it into the film. And so that's kind of what we're here to discuss. But I wanted to just back up just so you could tell us a little bit about sort of you grew up in
Milwaukee. Well, I was an Army brat. I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And my dad was a career Army soldier. He retired as an E-9 from the 101st Airborne.
And you have a Semper Fi hat on right now.
I joined the Marines when I graduated from high school in 83, from Cleveland High School. But I was the first 10 years of my life, I was an Army brat. We lived over in Europe. We lived all over the United States. So I lived in the South. I lived in the North. You know, of course, now I lived in the West. And came here in 76 because my grandfather was here. My grandfather moved here from New Albany, Mississippi in 1935. And stayed here until he passed away. And so that's how we came out here, because my mother wanted us to have roots, as they put it. And so after I got out of the Marines, I went into real estate.
And you were living in, before you went into the Corps, you were living here in Northeast.
Correct. I live on the corner of Mallory and Jarrett right now, but I've always lived within 5 blocks where I'm at right now. So I've lived on 2 houses in Mallory. And I used to live on Haight Street, and the last house I lived in before I moved out was on Cleveland Street, which is where my career started. And a lot of my business came from a lot of the old Black people who moved here in the early part of the century. You know, and that's why
pre-Vanport folks?
Pre-Vanport folks.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of post-Vanport folks, too. Only about 30% of the Black population in Oregon can trace their heritage back prior to 1900. The other 70% is post 1900, with about half of those people being World War II.
And so Vanport, is, for those who don't know, was a big sort of shipbuilding workers community that was constructed temporarily here in Portland, between Portland and Vancouver, and then it was all wiped out in a flood.
Well, the old Black folks consider that attempted murder. They didn't say it wiped out. They said the white folks in Portland City Council tried to murder all the Black folks and poor folks.
They think, yeah, the dams broke on purpose.
Correct.
That's a rumor out there. Of course, we do.
Oh, no, that's how it was taught to me. I met nobody, and that includes the white folks, when I was growing up, that did not feel that was attempted murder.
That can be a whole nother cut out or left out part of the series.
The whole thing maybe being attempted murder has popped up in the last 20 years because all these old people have died off.
We do interview James Harrison, who's probably the city's leading expert and scholar on Vanport, and we asked him directly, was it on purpose? And he says there's no evidence for that, according to him.
Well, the old Black folks would say, of course.
Of course. Of course.
Right. And even if there was evidence, all those white folks are dead. What are you going to do?
Well, so, you know
it doesn't do any good for me now. But
we can talk about
my
that.
My grandfather literally went to his grave and said, them people tried to murder us. Period. Well, you see, the reason why they felt it was murder, and again, remember, I've talked to a lot of the old white people who were there too, and they felt the same thing, was that the Army Corps of Engineers did approach the city of Portland and ask them to evacuate their area. And the mayor we had at that time flat out said, we don't need to. And he did not want those jigs. Back then, they called black people jigs, not niggs. Today, they said, we don't want those jigs. They didn't know where the jigs were going to go. There were so many more. See, black back then, a lot of people don't know this. The black community was where Moda Center is right now.
The old school.
Right there. Yeah. And he had a little bit in Northwest Portland, just a tiny bit. And he still had a little bit in close in Northwest Portland. Not much, but the heart of it was Fremont going all the way down to the river where the Memorial Coliseum is. There was not enough room to put all the black people there. So what is a white person who's a mayor is thinking? Oh, my God, if we get these black folks out of Vanport, they're going to be living everywhere. You understand? And this is why I tell people I understand about the disconnect between who we vote for and how people are. That's why I tell my white friends. There are parts of Inner North, there are parts of Portland where the white people wouldn't have cared. And there were parts where they did care. Like if you wanted to move in the East Moreland or Lowerhurst, the white folks, they cared. If a black person wanted to live in Clinton, they wanted to live in Buckman, the white folks there wouldn't have cared. You understand? But the thing is, you're mayor and you're looking at the map of the city. And back then, the city ended at 82nd. You understand? It ended at 82nd. It didn't go out to, like it goes out today. That didn't happen for another 40 years. So go up to 82nd. He's looking at the whole thing on the east side going, oh, my God, I may walk out of my house one day and there may be jigs just walking down the street going to our schools. So he didn't want to warn everybody to leave because they couldn't figure out what to do with the black folks.
And there were white people there. There were white people there. And there were Japanese too, who were interned and then returned from their internment and stationed there. But you got
to looked at those white folks a little lower because they would associate, with black people.
And they were kind of lower class whites. And they were, a lot of them were from the South. And this is post-Civil War. They were all considered undesirable.
This is post-World War II. They weren't too fond of Japanese people. Basically, this is what happens when your government has a population they just don't care about. You understand?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what I'm getting to is, what's fascinating about Vanport is the people of Portland did exactly the opposite of what the mayor and the city council thought they'd do at the time. Because really, white people came to the rescue of a lot of black people down there. I'm sure you've heard a lot of the stories. And black people lived all over the city. Yeah. For a little while. I mean, in Southwest Portland, there are a few black people who are temporarily living in like Skyline, an area which was even back then a pretty expensive area. And this literally drove a lot of white folks nuts. So you had this conflict. You had white folks that said, hey, these are people. We need to help them. Ultimately, it helped integrate Inner Northeast Portland, because then that's when they let the dogs out and said black people could live north of Fremont.
Mm-hmm.
That's when the whole thing going north. And that's why you don't hear of anybody who can trace their family living, let's say, in Piedmont or Walnut Park, stuff like that, or University Park or whatever, before, Vanport.
And it just is an interesting little side point. Mm-hmm. What I was told when we were doing these interviews from the historians and reading stuff, you see that the black folks from Vanport were from the South.
Correct.
And had a kind of a different culture compared to those maybe more conservative black folks. I mean, what I've been, read, described
as
like
they were kind of
like more northern sort of Yankee black folks.
They like to call it Yankee black, but it's called Portland black.
Okay.
Portland does its own racism. It's its way. And Portland had... biggest gangster that's ever been, the most powerful criminal, was a black man named Tom Johnson. And he came here in the early 1920s. And pretty much, if it was on the east side and it was criminal related, we're talking about anything. And Tom had the power to make you disappear. You understand what I'm talking about? In other words, if Tom didn't like what you were doing or whatever, you just didn't feel you need to be here. You just weren't here. That's why you don't hear about a lot of stories in the Black community of, you know, a lot of murders and stuff. Please, trust me, there were murders, but they were different than what people do today. You know, gangsters today, you know, they do drive-by shootings. Tom Johnson had a guy basically killed and cremated because he robbed a pastor here in Portland. And they cremated him and just put his ashes in the Willamette River. They didn't believe in the spectacle. They didn't believe in the spectacle of what we, you know, of what gangsters do today. Matter of fact, when I grew up listening to my grandfather and his friends, they'd see pimps and other guys, you know, thugging around, and they would just say, "These guys are crazy. They're letting the cops know who they are, and then when they go do stuff, they're letting the whole world know they do stuff." You know, I grew up with the whole thing about these guys talking about
everyone did it underground.
Everybody did it underground. Yeah. They didn't like the flash. Yeah, you understand?
Yeah, yeah.
The whole thing about was that you get your own and you keep it. You don't let people know that you got it.
Right, right.
Conservative. Well, yeah. The new people that came in, think about it. You're coming from Arkansas or Mississippi in the 1930s, and you come out to a place like Portland, Oregon. I mean, Portland's racist. Portland has this racism. It does. But you cannot put Portland racism in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, anywhere near what they saw in the South. It wasn't it wasn't even close. You know, you had businesses that did business with Black people. You know, we had restaurants that said no color. But we also had restaurants that said no Mongoloid. We also had restaurants that said no Hebrews.
And no Catholics. And no Irish. Catholics. Yeah, yeah.
So in other words, what my grandfather and his friends always liked about Portland was that there was a space for Black people. They used to say, at least they let Black people eat here. You know what I mean? Back where they were from, you couldn't eat. We had clubs we could go to. We had restaurants we could go to. We had, we could get on public transportation, which freaked a lot of Black people out. My grandfather used to talk about getting on the trolleys here in Portland because he was way into trains when he was a kid.
Mm.
And he said, you know, yeah, I didn't mind sitting in the back, but nobody ever asked me to give up my seat. You know what I mean? He goes, I can sit on the trolley, but I had to sit in the back. You know, he did say that. But the thing is, they were just fascinated that they could even do it, because a lot of these people, where they came from, it was like, you see it, it was nice, you can't do that.
Yeah. So what's the modern Black man's perspective? You know, Portland Black man, well, how does he cope with racism? Does he have the same attitude as his grandfather? Or
no.
Is it different?
Well, like I can tell people, the old, you know, we shall overcome Black folks are dying off like World War II vets. You know, Black people, you know, every decade has been exposed to more and more freedoms. So a lot of these things that the Black folks back in the day, you know, thought were, you know, okay, I can accept this level. You know what I'm saying? We're beyond that. You know, we're beyond that. And I tell people, this shows you just how deep racism is. You know, I tell people, don't think about it, guys. This is the best it's ever been, and it still sucks. You know what I mean? We're not as free as our white friends are. We got to be more cautious. We got to put more thought. We're challenged a lot more because we go through everything our white friends and family go through, everything. And then we got racism on top of it, you know, that comes through. So, yeah, you know, we still got racism. But in Portland, we still got that racism of it's not like it is in the South. You know what I mean? We don't have that. Let's just say there's always a workaround. A white person always knows, I don't have to give him what he wants. I'll give him something, but I'm not going to give him what he wants. You know what
you mean?
I
mean, just like political promises?
Political promises. Well, you know, I tell everybody, the gang problem. The gang problem started 30 years ago next month in Portland, as far as officially. But it actually started being talked about by the Portland police in 1984, when the LA gangs came up here. And in 1988, they estimated there were no more than about 100, maybe 150 Black gang members. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm talking about? And they're not really like hardcore. They're Portland boys. Mm-hmm. I went to high school with some of these guys. You know what I'm talking about? So our gang members aren't like the gang members in LA. But the LA guys who came up here, they're like the gang members in LA. And they're the ones who were, you know, pushing. What I'm getting to is, had the city of Portland cared about Black people, we did not need to have a Black gang problem in Portland. We didn't need to have. It was very small up until about 1990. I think in 1990 they were estimating that 600 or 700 or something like that. But they knew who everybody was who was like going that direction, and they knew who the LA gang members were. But the city of Portland back then, you know, they just didn't care. I mean, gangs started hitting here, in my opinion. Some of us go, we go back even in the late 70s, we start seeing this gang mentality hitting Portland. But let's get fast forward to 30 years ago right now. 30 years ago right now, we had a lot of vacant homes. Inner North and Northeast Portland had approximately 400 vacant homes at the time. When I say vacant, I mean nobody lived there. Nobody gave a darn. We had people who lived on all over the world who were still paying property taxes.
10% of the homes in Northeast Portland were vacant.
Yeah, were just straight vacant. Yeah. And gang members started selling drugs out of them and creating whorehouses and stables and stuff like that. And, it, you know, it was a mess. And as the gangs started increasing, the first victims of gangs in Portland were black people. Black people were basically victimizing other black people over here in Northeast Portland. You know, at that time, I was trying to get my family out of Portland. We had so many shootings on Northeast Cleveland Street. My mother lives just off of Alberta and Cleveland. I personally had given up in Northeast, like a lot of black people. A lot of black people said, I'm getting the heck out of here. And they either abandoned their properties or they sold them if they could find somebody to take it. And they got the heck out. And that's what I wanted to do. Ago, I carried a gun most places I went. You know, I mean, that's what I'm trying to say. It was absolutely wild in Northeast Portland, and I'm surprised people were surprised that black people wanted to get the heck out.
Where were they going 30 years ago?
A lot of them left Oregon. A lot of them left Oregon, but also, too, they went to places like Vancouver. They went to places like Milwaukee. They went to the Four Winds, but a lot left Portland. I tell people, grab a yearbook from the 1970s and then early to mid 1980s. Just go down to the school district and just say from the high schools that existed back then, let me have your yearbooks. And this would be a fascinating study for you. Go find all those black people, especially the ones who were winning awards to the Honor Society and, you know, were getting into college. We had black guys I grew up with that when they got into college, that was the last time I ever saw them. You know what I mean? They would go to their colleges and build a life anywhere but Portland. You understand? And they wouldn't come back. Now, some of them are beginning to come back now, but they're rich. But what fascinates me, and this is, I tell people, even if a black guy grew up here, graduated and went to college and made it big, let's say like one family I know where the guy went up and became pretty high ranked at Coca-Cola. He's a millionaire, right? When they decided to move back to Oregon, you know, he still couldn't get himself to buy in Northeast Portland. You understand? He even though he was here like 2 years ago and it's, you know, awesome. When I'm driving down the street saying, man, check this out. Look at this. And he goes, yeah, I remember the old, that looks nice.
Yeah, he can't shake the memory.
But he can't shake the memory.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Of what he went through growing up, you know, in the hood. So where he bought two houses, one on the coast, and he bought one in Lake Oswego, and he feels good. He's fine, you know.
So is that a typical kind of mindset of the average African American that left here during the 80s and the 90s that they don't want to return?
I'd say right now, most never return. Once they leave and they establish their life someplace else, but the ones that do return, they don't necessarily feel an affinity to Inner Northeast. They've made it. You understand? And when they were growing up here, that's what their dreams was, to go out and make something of themselves and not be subject to what they experienced over here in Northeast Portland. You know, I equate it to, you know, like I was explaining to this woman one day, I go, you know, pardon me, ma'am, but this is how a lot of black people look at Inner Northeast Portland. Not the people who are still here today mostly, but a lot of the successful ones that have left. I know a lot of people that love sex. Love it. I don't know anybody.
Where are we going with this, Brent?
I don't know anybody who likes to be raped. Nobody.
Right.
And I said, and that is kind of what happened when you've got a population of people who are like 50 and older, who are forced to live in an area, who are subject to all the racism and all the, you know, the underserved and all the stigma, you know, just seeing an address, 30 years ago. Hey, I lived at 5802 Northeast Mallory. Ooh, you live in the hood. You live in the, you know, I mean, that changed relationships immediately. They didn't want any of that. That's why when a lot of, even the ones that stayed, a lot of the black people, when they were, you know, made it or became successful, they would go to addresses that people respected. Lake Oswego, West Lynn. You understand? I mean, look at where the Blazers. We have never had a Blazer live in inner Northeast Portland, ever. And you know who tells them not to live there? It ain't the white folks. You understand what I'm talking about? Well, I've talked to a lot of the old ones, and they, you know what they said? The black folks will say, you got money, boy. You don't need to be buying anything over here.
So what's happening to prevent this? Because I mean, you're saying it, but it's easy to identify that it's negative. That's wrong. Mm-hmm. Like, that's draining the community of its most precious commodity.
Correct.
And so what can we do to go another direction here?
It's too late for us as it is right now. I don't think you can change it. The only thing you can do is hopefully here and other places prevent it from happening in other places. We're such a small community. We're 30,000 black people. And, you know, we knew in 1990 that by the year 2000, we would have more black people living outside of Multnomah County than in. And they were right. Year 2010, we're expecting 2020, yeah. There's going to be absolutely more. I think it's going to be double. In other words, there's going to be twice as many black people who live in Clackamas and Washington County than live in Multnomah County. And that's going to be the first time it's gotten that bad since black people migrated from Jefferson County. We're talking 1920.
There were 60,000 black people in Oregon.
Well, there's about 70, actually, in Oregon, or, you know, roughly about 70. So we're not even 100,000 people. Mm-hmm. And roughly half of all those black people, roughly, live in Portland, in the Portland market. Mm-hmm. But it's the Portland market, not the city limits of Portland. Mm-hmm.
So with there being, how do we attract new black money? Because this is now a prestigious address. Like, Northeast is now an address that says, I have money, I've made it.
You're
so
right.
How do we attract new black money into Northeast? Or is it just really a lost cause? Like,
I think it's a lost cause. We had a bigger problem with just attracting black people to come to Portland in the first place.
It is hard.
So, you know, we can't even get, we've literally had black basketball players, right, who are free agents and can get mad money from the Blazers, say, hell no, I ain't going to Portland.
But is that because they just didn't want to be in the Blazers?
Or No. Portland has got
the tough
a reputation
sometimes.
Of having a lot of, I mean, you can, if you're not from here, it takes you a while to see where the racism hits you. It takes you a little bit to catch. And a lot of black people don't, they'd rather have the in your face. They see it. They know where to go.
Right.
You understand that and everything. Mm-hmm. Whereas over here, it's like being gang raped by a ghost. Sometimes, you know, you've been hit and you're at home. You're like, I know I've been violated.
Right.
I got to figure out how.
Right.
I know I've been violated.
You know, in the South, they just put you on the news here. They hand it to you and say it's a silk tie.
Yeah, it's a necktie.
Can you put it on?
Exactly. Put it on yourself. Put it on yourself. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, same thing. That's exactly. And a lot of successful black people, right, don't want to subject themselves. So they want to be able to see it coming. You understand? So they can deal with it. They don't want to. Like I said in my video last night, people forget that there is a humiliation factor to racism.
Yeah,
nobody likes, we don't talk about it. I mean, that much to white people. Nobody wants to tell your oppressor, you just humiliated me. You know what I'm talking about? Nobody wants to talk about that. But that there's a part of that. And nobody wants to go through that, you know, over and over again, you know, where they don't see it coming. And so, like I said, right now, friends, in Portland, Oregon, our basketball manager, O'Shea, I guarantee you, is having a hard time convincing black basketball players, some of the top basketball players on planet Earth, right? Do not want to play in Portland because they don't want to live here. They don't want to party here. They don't trust the white folks of Portland, Oregon. And the white folks of Portland, Oregon, most of them are nice. But they look at the policies. They look at how the cops treat people. You know what I mean? And Portland people that are voters, the white people, most of my white friends, they don't understand that most of the people they vote for, not all, because we have great people like Vera Katz and Bud Clark and stuff, awesome people, did a lot to help black people in Portland. But what I'm saying is a lot of the people we vote for that are white don't give a darn at all. You understand? I mean, they're not like you. I tell my friends, I said, you want a better world. You moved in the inner northeast Portland because you wanted your kid to grow up around minorities. Well, that person you vote for, they don't give a look at their policies. Mm. You know, I mean, look at the things they haven't done.
And that kind of brings up something you said to me that was very powerful years ago about the crime and about the gang wars. And you said something like the number of black folks that were killed here during the gang wars and the percentage of the population that essentially was killed.
You figure.
And that if that had happened in the white community, you basically would have had martial law.
Oh, yeah, we would have martial law. In 1989. We had 90 black guys killed in Portland, Oregon in that year alone. 88 or 90. Let's call it 90. 80, that year alone. Well, you know, we only had, in Portland, Oregon, maybe 20,000, black people. Yeah. Now, think about it. The average age of those people that were killed were about 20 years old that year. Mm-hmm. Now, imagine a population that small having nearly 100 of his young men murdered in the streets. You understand? To give you an idea, we had probably about 240,000 white people living in Portland. So what if we had, let's say 2,000 white guys.
I can't do the math, but are you doing the math?
20 years old, I'm doing the math.
You're doing the math.
20 years old, killed in the streets.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean? White Portland would have gone absolutely nuts. The mayor would have had martial law.
Yeah, there would have been tanks in the street.
Yeah. I mean, it would have been. But what they did with black folks is they just put more guns on the street. And when I say more guns on the street, they sent more cops out. They didn't accept that this was a small population that was easily identifiable. You understand that we can go and put our hands on these people right now and get them out of the community. No, what happened was black gangs became a government financial center. A lot of people started, black and white, mostly white, but black people too, started making money off of gangs. So they didn't want to go after and attack the gang problem at the level that we could have. They started treating Portland like it was Los Angeles.
Right.
You understand? And I'll tell you something that's going to crack you up. In 1990, when we were doing our urban renewal stuff, the mayor of Portland really had to work hard. We came in, when it comes to like depressed areas of the United States, we came in at like initially at 101. You had to be in the top 100 to be able to get urban renewal. So in other words, there were about 100 other communities around the country that were poor than the black community in Portland, as poor as we were. And trust me, we were poor, right? Mm. And so it shows you that the city had an opportunity when the problem was really small, you understand, to nip in the bud, because the first black gang members were basically just bad. Were just bad boys. You know what I'm talking about? Misbehaving.
And this is exactly what Rashawn Muhammad was talking about in a previous podcast.
Yeah, they weren't hardcore like the movie Colors. They weren't like that.
That's exactly what Rashawn said.
Black guys from Portland would go to see that movie Colors to learn how to be gang members.
That's exactly what Rashawn said.
They go, oh man, I'm going to go see that movie Colors. And then next thing you know, everybody started dressing like the guys in the movie. You know how many guys look like those guys after that movie came out? Because everybody's hitting up the store.
Now, what you said also was the, and I didn't ever consider this, is the impact that all of those homicides had on just relationships.
Yeah.
Just like you had, because you have a very small community.
Correct.
Which then all of a sudden is ripped with all these homicides. And well, all those people were killed by somebody who had family, and were the victims had family, and they had to
You had first cousins. We've had first cousins kill first cousins. Mm-hmm. We've had black guys that had grown up together, lived next door, dads and moms went to school together. You understand? Yeah. If somebody kills somebody in your family, brother, father, uncle that you care about or whatever, how are you going to feel about that family? You know, how are you going to feel about that guy? That gets in the way of a lot of community bonding. Yeah. You understand what I'm talking about? That gets in the way.
What were some of the community resources that were available to help individuals deal with trauma? Because typically in African American community, we try to do it through church. And this is a community I've learned is somewhat not a very religious community in general.
We used to
like
be.
Other ones.
We used to be. But. And these killings, the black church's influence in the black community. And I've argued about this with a lot of the black preachers because, you know, of course, they don't want to admit it, though I think some understand it's true. What happened when the gangs started coming in, they are a reflection of the breakdown of that community bonding. You hear what I'm talking about? Mm-hmm. They were a reflection of that. And, you know, it happened at a perfect time. When the gangs hit Portland, it just coincided when a lot of the old guard black preachers and black leaders were dying out. They were sick and they were dying out. I believe it wouldn't have happened had the leadership at that time, the old leadership, had been 10 years, you know, younger. You know what I'm talking about? Could have been around a little while past, you know, Reverend Jackson, I think of, and stuff like that, and several others. They just passed away. And, you know, the younger people that came in, they were more about being people's buddies than they were about being their mentors and their leaders. You understand? In our right. community. So we lost a lot of incredible wisdom and leadership, you know, just because of time. You know what I mean? The number of black young men and women who have been murdered in gang violence since 1988 is somewhere right around 550, 560. And I'm praying that we don't make it, you know, anywhere near, you know, 600. But just think of the loss of our community. You understand? And you never hear anybody talk about that. The massive loss of opportunity, of life. And I know a lot of people can just say, hey, they were gang members, you know, whatever. They weren't all gang members. We had a lot of black people who were shot accidentally. You know what I mean? They were just caught in the crossfire. A lot of people want a water cutter. This is why I jump on the media for not hiring black people for journalism work. They let white people articulate what black people think or should think, but they don't hire black people, especially from the community, to write those stories. You understand? And I argue with all the editors, you know, about this, because I'm like, guys.
As he looks at me.
You did reach out to a lot of black people. But there's editors here that I know for a fact have absolutely no inclination on even interviewing black people. Their opinion of black people, and they're nice people. You know, it's funny, like I tell some of my white friends, these are nice racist editors. You know what I'm saying? They're nice. They're not like David Duke. They're not going to say, well, you know, Fred, you know, he's one of them uppity niggers or nothing. But yeah, he'll say that maybe in a room where he trusts everybody. You understand? But, you know, he's going to hate everything about me because I'm so confident and everything. And I don't care whether, you know, him and I are ever going to be friends or not. You see what I'm talking?
Right.
They have no absolutely regard for black people at all. And that's why they don't hire black people to tell the black story. There's people in your movie. I'm like, wow, where did they talk about, you know, Northeast Portland? How come the Oregonian isn't hiring that person? You know what I'm talking about? I mean, they don't even recruit. They don't even go to MIT. You know, so this is what I was teasing the guy. I go, dude, you went to MIT. And he says, yeah, I went to MIT. And I said, have you ever thought about seeing if anybody black from MIT wants to come to Portland? Oh, I don't think so. I'm like, you went to school with all of those smart people at MIT. Killing me. Well, you know who's black and did go to MIT? Lou Frederick, right? Lou Frederick is a historical figure, in my opinion. When he came to Portland, he was completely unusual, and all the old black folks loved him to death. You know what I'm talking about?
Lou Frederick, who was a TV reporter at KGW.
He was a TV reporter.
And then moved on, now a state rep.
It was him and John Davidson. And they were popular. They were successful. And Lou's always been great at articulating the black experience in Portland. Always been, right? That's why they got rid of his butt. You hear what I'm talking about? If he had come here and been, you know, what my grandfather used to call the Jethro type of Negro. You know, Jethro, come over here. Tell these people I'm a nice person. You know what I'm talking about? If he had been one of those guys, he probably would have been anchor.
We want to get into all that.
We got to bring this up for you as a thing. And then I'm going to shut up. Oregon fully invested in the drug war. Fully invested. Our liberals fully invested in the incarceration and mistreatment of black people in Portland legally. You understand?
Yeah.
All of them.
That's a great place to leave it. So we've talked about pimps. So that means we have to talk about politicians next.
Yep.
So, and we're going to get a little bit deeper into the statement you just brought up, because you're not the first guest who has said that to us. Mm-hmm. So there's something to that conversation. That's a conversation.
And they get rid of white people who are in politics, who call them out for it. You want to see a white guy's political career, you know, go away? Have him come to Portland and say, hey, white folks, hey, progressives, how come you're putting all the Negroes in prison?
Yeah.
You know, oh, but he's not going to, you know what? I don't think this is going to work out. I don't think you need to go get a job someplace else.
All right. So it's time for us to wrap this one up. Part two coming really soon.
Yep.
So we'll roll into all of the political issues, but we stopped at the gang wars. So the next will be your career in real estate.
Okay.
And then gentrification, your view of gentrification and redlining.
Okay.
Straight up to the current state of politics and the media here locally and nationally.
And we should also talk about, like I said, I've been trying to get this out more about the fact that it was Gretchen Cifore and Jim Francesconi that ended redlining in Portland.
Yes. Yeah. We'll definitely talk about that.
It was their efforts that put, but black people didn't know. They didn't know that they did it. But black people definitely didn't know.
Well, we will hear about that, and then everyone will know on the next show. Thanks, everybody.
All right.